Find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself here at Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer and Sönke Löw.
Today we are going to talk about a topic in which I don't have any scientific experience, but I have like some practical experience because I am currently writing my master's thesis and I'm sitting in front of a window and sometimes people pass by and I get distracted a lot. And today we are going to talk about the visual attention and mechanisms and the distraction. And for that, as always, we have invited an expert and we like to welcome Erik.
Hello.
And as always, as a short warm-up, we play our short get-to-know game, where I'm going to give five sentence beginnings and we'll ask Erik to finish them spontaneously. Are you ready?
I am very ready.
Okay. The first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be...
Bigger.
Bigger.
Because I wanted to be a grown-up, I guess. I mean, this is what comes spontaneously to my mind. I think I just saw what other people were doing and what I was not allowed to do. And then, of course, I wanted to also do all the fun activities that other people were doing. But I don't know what specifically that would entail. I don't know. Also, this strikes me. I mean, I also wanted to always be, I think, a scientist. I think that was really interesting to me. I mean, now I started with the whole thought process on this question. And I mean, it kind of goes in the direction of like what I want to do for a job. So I think I always wanted to be like a biologist or do something with nature. And so being a grown up doing something with nature, that was always something I like to do.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, the question is of, as a kid, I always wanted to be, doesn't directly target towards job. It's just what you've been wanting to do. But it's funny because we've had the answer of being a grown up before once. And I did not expect anyone to go into that direction. And I just really like that it came up twice now. The second sentence is, if I was an emoji, I would be.
For some time, the hazelnut emoji was my favorite emoji.
Really? Why?
No, I think for no specific reason. I think it was vastly underrepresented. And so I just chose it. And then I would react in random chats with a hazelnut emoji just as a like, as a thing of to say, like, here I am. I don't know. I don't know whether a hazelnut represents me well. I don't know. I don't know whether there's an emoji which describes me very well, but I like the hazelnut emoji for some time.
I mean, it's nice to have a food as a primary emoji.
Yeah, I'm now a bit worried that there's some underlying meaning, because now we went into like this meta meaning for all the emojis and I like have no idea anymore what all of them should mean. So yeah, I hope there is no hidden bad meaning for the hazelnut.
Well, if one of our listeners has any more specific meaning for a hazelnut, please just let us know and we will warn Erik about it. Our third sentence is, my favorite thing to do on a day off is...
I really like hiking. And so recently I lived in the mountains and that was really nice. So I would go hiking in the weekends and also climbing, which is a thing you can combine really well. So you would need to grab a couple of friends, grab your climbing gear, and then just walk to the next crack and then you can climb there for the day. And I think that's overall really nice. And it's something like you can sit a bit like in the nature and then have something also which is stimulating in a, like a different way, because you need to shut your head off so much, because if you think, then you will not be able to climb. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also something which is really nice there. And yeah, just I think all these kind of sports which are also a bit dangerous lead you to having you need to be so focused on the sport that, you need to shut off. And I think that's something really nice there. And I'm terribly afraid, but that's the enjoyable part as well.
I mean, I can relate to that. I used to go bouldering until like half a year ago, but I stopped. But I'm always super afraid of falling. I'm not afraid of heights, but I'm just afraid of falling down for some reason. Like climbing up is no issue as long as I've got enough stuff to hold on to in an emergency. But just once I start thinking about where I could fall, it's just over. Right now, I'm most fascinated by.
Oh, I don't know whether there's something I'm fascinated by. I'm like concerned by a lot of things, but this is like a lot of political things. So I don't know. I don't know whether there's something I'm deeply fascinated, being it scientific, political. I think, currently there's nothing which holds my fascination above all else. Sorry to disappoint there.
That's totally fine. And our last sentence is, I know it's time to call it a day when...
When I just don't want to do anything anymore. I think my work rhythm is filled with procrastination. So I cannot even say I would call it a day once I'm procrastinating, because then I would not work. Or like would call it a day after 5 minutes. But I think it's just like the feeling of like, okay, now I'm getting too tired. And now it's too late, and I just cannot get the motivation to get from procrastination back to actual work.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally fair. Nonetheless, although you said you tend to procrastinate, you have already finished your master's so far, and I would like to know a bit where you started, what you did in your bachelor's, what you did in your master's, and what your main topics of interest were during your whole time of studies.
I started my bachelor's studying cognitive science in Osnabrück. And the story how I came there was I was doing a gap year, a freiwilliges ökologisches Jahr, which is translated to voluntary ecological year in English. It's kind of this thing in Germany you can do. And I was at a seminar and somebody told me, Eric, there's this crazy program with these crazy people in Osnabrück and you would totally fit there. You should go there. And then I looked at it and I like Osnabrück. So I signed up for it, and somehow I also got the position there, got the place. And I was really happy just because it was so broad. So I think this is also what I experienced there with a lot of people, that it's just a really wide field of things you can try out. So initially, I thought I would like psychology a lot. And then overall, I don't know whether I did not follow in like psychology studies. Like I did not really major in psychology. I did some stuff, but I, for example, did not go to a lot of lectures in the psychology faculty, in the psychology institute. So overall there, it was a really mixed bag, and I also enjoyed really to work in computer science related things and with machine learning and AI things. And yeah, but also linguistics really intrigued me, and this will come in, make sense later for my bachelor's thesis. And I also was there and tutored in linguistics, and that was all great. And there was a lot of different stuff. And I think languages also was always such a fascinating topic. But then once you open it, you feel like, oh God, I need to define everything now. Like you start out thinking about it, and then you notice, okay, every time I start thinking about it, it's such a rabbit hole. And so I think it's very interesting to ponder, but I would never research it because I feel like it's such a fuzzy thing to research, and it's really cool for everybody who does it. Yeah, so I studied long and studied long, and then at some point the question came about, what do I want to do basically in my bachelor's thesis? And then in my bachelor's thesis, I was like, okay, I want to do also something somehow meaningful. And so I wrote about basically the state of the generic masculine form in German based on the German federal elections. So in German, we have grammatical gender, not in all languages. English does not have it. They have different stuff. A lot of languages have a lot of different gender systems, but I think I will not go in depth. I think this is would be too extensive. And so I just designed a study there. It was an online study also during COVID time. So it was very handy to do a study online and try to find out basically how people, students in this case, would use the generic masculine form and how, like, whether they were open to kind of alternative forms as well. And so there's a lot of problems with just using the generic masculine forms. There are stereotypes which are very apparent once you start reading anything about it in a psychological sense. And I just wanted to see also, is there, for example, processing difficulties with a like a artificial neutral form? So we have these kind of new waveforms which also include all genders. And this was really interesting to me. The spoiler is, it happens. We are very open to new forms, at least we young people. So the demographics were like 35 and younger. So I don't know what also says something, I think. So yeah, that was really interesting to me. And that was, of course, also something with psychology and then, but also a bit related to language. Because yeah, it was about our language use. And so that terminated then my bachelor, and I was really happy, but also a bit lost. And then I wanted to continue something. And I really liked what was happening in Osnabrück at the IKW, the Institute for Cognitive Science. And I thought, yeah, I would like to study there again, but I would also like to expand my... yeah, expand further and go see different things again. I think I was also interested in neuroscience. I was just not keen about the neuroscience happening in Osnabrück somehow. And so I actually took then the chance to do a double degree with the University of Osnabrück and University of Trento in Italy. And they have the standing double degree program. And that was really nice because in they have like kind of different focus. And so in Trento, I did then a major in cognitive neuroscience. And that was really cool because there I learned more on this side of cognitive science, which I also see now. I mean, I think everybody says my side of cognitive science is the true side of cognitive science. And if you research it in any other way, you're wrong. But currently, I think... cognitive neuroscience is on a very good track to understand the mind and people. And also there is not my favorite kind of research, but consciousness. So also very like high level things on the mind, I think also have a good standing in cognitive neuroscience. And so, yeah, and this is where I then studied for 1 year in Osnabrück. Then I went to Italy and studied there 1 year. And then I... also wrote a master thesis there, which was concerning a human visual attention. And I don't know, I think we will talk a bit more about this.
Yes. So you wrote your master's thesis with the University of Trento, was that?
Yeah.
Or did you write it at the Institute for Cognitive Science in Osnabrück?
Yeah, so it's the thing with the double degree, you write it with everyone. So I wrote it with in the University of Trento. This is the easy answer. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, University of Osnabrück had some say in it. And Peter Koenig, Professor Peter Koenig from the University of Osnabrück, was actually also evaluating my thesis. But then also the project, which we did, was also a collaboration with the University of Leipzig.
Oh,
so okay. Now there's a third player. Yeah.
Okay.
So let's say the main work was in... Trento, sorry.
Okay. And how did you come to that topic? Because that sounds super messy. And like, you've been studying at two universities, which is already quite a lot. But then you just mentioned that you also got Leipzig as an additional part. So how did you find this topic? And was it posted somewhere? Did you apply for it? How did that happen?
Yeah. So as I said before, I went to Trento. I was not so into the topic of neuroscience. So I wanted to really dive deeper into neuroscience and also get hands-on with cognitive neuroscience. And so what I did, and I think this is really important when someone writes their thesis or some other big work, you should find a person you want to write the thesis with. So I went to a professor, Professor Veronika Matza, and I had a course with her. And I thought with her, I would really like to write my thesis. And I knew what she was doing. She was studying attention and perception in general. She is head of the perception, attention, perception and aging lab in Trento at the CIMEC. And then I talked with her and I said, I would like to study with EEG, electroencephalography, which is this technique where you can measure the electrical, what is the electrical currents on the skull, basically. And this is correlated to the cognitive processes. And so I knew I wanted to do that also because I thought this is a really widespread method, and I wanted to get hands on there. And I thought it was a good starting point, basically. And since then, I also advanced, basically, and now I want to do all these other methods. But so then I just started out working with her, and firstly, I did helped at another project and learned how to use the EEG device and how to set up the cap, because there's some protocol, of course, how to use it. And then after some time, she came up with this topic and said, yeah, we have this project here, and there is someone coming from the University of Leipzig, and we'll need to collect 30 participants. Oh, no, it was actually in the beginning, it was only 18 participants. 18 participants in 2 weeks, which is super heavy somehow, because you have like 3 participants a day, and this is like 2 hours per participant, and you need to be attentive always because every measurement must be good. And so she basically offered me then this project, and I was really glad that she came around with it. So this is basically how I came up with this project.
Interesting. So just to wrap it up, you wrote your master's thesis on attention and used EEG for measurement.
Yes.
Can you maybe briefly explain what attention is in general?
Yeah. This is, I think, also already interesting, and there are different ways to look at it. And so I think maybe it's easy to look at it a bit from a psychological perspective. In general, we can say we have perception and we perceive all the world around us with all our different senses, but we can only process and actually process so much information at once, and somehow we need to only attend a subset of the things we have in our whole surrounding. And especially if we have some task either set by a different person or by ourselves, that's something we want to achieve, then we also need to focus on a specific subset of items in our surrounding. So attention sometimes is like prescribed as a kind of a spotlight, which is on the like perceptual landscape which is around you, which is already really abstract again, but it's just like it tries to just take the subset of things in your surrounding.
So basically, when I'm, just to make it a bit more practical, when I'm sitting in a room, or right now I am sitting in my room, actually, because we are doing an online recording once again. And I have lots of items around me. And I can either decide to focus on my laptop and on my screen to see you, or I could focus on looking out of the window and see or look into the next house, or I could put my attention to the mess that's surrounding me and focus on those on those items. Is that what attention is? So like just focusing or deciding on where or which parts of my surroundings or which parts of the environment I mostly would like to perceive.
Yeah, I think you described that quite well, but I think it's also important to stress here that it's kind of the scope can be differently sized, basically, so you can have a very wide attention and you're not focusing on something very narrow. So you could say my attention is relatively open, or if you have something, are more doing something precise, like recording a podcast, then you maybe don't look around in your room so much, but kind of focus on the task on hand and on the talks that you have, like on the talk you're having now or something like this. Yeah.
And you use EEG to measure the attention, but are there other ways? So like I remember that you could also use, for example, eye gaze tracking on images, or I don't know, reaction times are also I think something people sometimes do. So what are the ways to measure how attentive a person is to a task, to an item, to whatever is surrounding them?
I think there are different ways to study attention, and EEG is one of them, but I think it's also important. Attention is kind of a thing which is always there. And I think usually and often also like specific aspects of attention are studied. And can have a wide attention or a narrow attention, but attention is kind of there. And then you can say, okay, someone attending specifically this item, which I'm showing them on the screen, for example. And then I think you can use eye gaze, for example. I think maybe also something pupil dilation is a thing which sometimes can be there. Then of course all neuroimaging things are there. So magnetoencephalography, electroencephalography, and I guess you can also use MRI for that. But attention is also studied in neuroscience and in psychology. So I think there should also be just a lot of reaction time and some kind of behavioral kind of tasks. So accuracy and reaction time. So if you did not attend something, but you should kind of act upon it and you are slower with reacting upon it, maybe you did not attend to it so well. So this is maybe a measure. And then also, you said eye gaze as well. But I think this is also an important thing you're saying, because we differentiate. So attention is a very broad term, but we differentiate a lot. So eye gaze, we can only observe if we talk about overt attention. So overt attention means visible from the outside. And this is something which is maybe specific to visual attention. And so the baseline for overt attention is basically once someone moves their eyes. So this is like in layman's terms, maybe once someone moves their eyes, you can see they attend something. So what you could imagine, this was basically the first experiments. People were sat on a chair and then they were shown a picture for a very short flash. And then maybe you should attend the red item. There were different items and you should attend the red item, not the green items. And then you can both attend the red item with or without moving your eyes. And so this moving your eyes, saccade, so this is a fast eye movement, usually starts around 200 milliseconds after stimulus onset, so after you showed the participant the item. And what I actually studied is covert attention. So without moving the eyes, so you would show them something, and ideally you would show that to them under 200 milliseconds, so they have no chance to move their eyes. We did it a bit longer. This is also something where some problems in the experiment arose, maybe foreshadowing. And yeah, so we studied covert attention. So you can also just, and there's a whole topic of just looking how people process the information if they just have this basically still image in their head, and you somehow can also attend only certain parts of the areas, even though you did not move your eyes across the image. And I think this is important that there are so many subcategories. So we looked at covert attention and then also at feature attention. So
can you maybe explain what feature attention is?
Yeah, this would be my next step. So we could, I think this for me, there are also, I mean, the literature is not clear on that, whether there's feature attention, spatial attention, or more. But basically, spatial attention is whether you're attending a specific area in a presented stimulus somehow. And I mean, presented stimulus is just a term for, I mean, this is something we do as researchers. We sit people in front of computer screens and then we present a stimulus, meaning we show them something on the screen. So this is maybe roughly what you can imagine from presented stimulus. So whether people just attend basically an area or features, whether they attend specific features. So this could be, for example, color, shape, angle, length, size, something like this. And if I say, look out for the red item, you cannot do anything with attending a special area of your screen, because if the item can be anywhere, but you should look for the red item, this is the information you have, then you need to somehow utilize feature attention, if I can say it like that, and you need to look for the feature red in this case. And so this is also what we did. So we had different items and people should look out for color.
Is the same thing possible for other kinds of attention and other senses, like auditory attention, for example? Do you know anything about that? If there's a certain pitch then people should listen out for, or is there an equivalent of that for other senses?
I mean, I am not an expert on that, but I can speculate together with you. And I think pitch was also the first thing which came to mind. Maybe young parents listen out to higher pitch stuff, or maybe, I don't know, if you are in the nature and you try to listen for birds and not for sheep, then you also listen to different pitches. So I can definitely imagine it like this. But it's also, visual attention is, I think, the most, so the visual domain is the most researched domain. It's very easy to design things and it's very researched. And I think this is why people, also like it so much. And then there's a problem of how applicable are our findings across modalities. So other modalities, visual modality, auditory modality, I mean, gustatory. I don't know whether we have attention there even. Tactile, this is all, but I mean, auditory is the thing which always comes up, of course, but it's not even that clear or that easily transferable from visual attention to auditory attention. And sometimes they are if you read papers, they kind of try to apply it also to auditory attention. But then you read it and you think did they write it because they wanted to make their paper cooler? Or is it actually a valid theory to just use it across modalities?
We've now talked a tiny bit about the setup. So you've explained that in your setup for the experiment, you had participants coming to the lab wearing an EEG cap, and they looked at a screen where they were asked to focus on a specific color, correct?
Yeah. So,
and how far did you then measure the covert attention?
Okay, so maybe a bit more. I don't know, I feel like I have to jump three topics back, basically. So what did we look at, actually? So what we were interested in, there is in attention, there is inhibition, and there's facilitation. And so this is kind of processes how you can have focused attention on something. You somehow need to facilitate the things you're looking out for and inhibit the things you don't want to attend. And for a long time, people just thought this are the same processes, like cognitive processes, and it's just like two sides of the same medal. But at some point, people found out, no, they are actually different processes for facilitation and for inhibition. And then 30 years ago, roughly, people started and began something without knowing it, what was now coined by some proponents of this debate, the attentional capture debate. And this debate is basically all about how people work with salient but irrelevant stimuli. So I came up with a good analogy recently. Let's see whether it works. So I used to talk about fruit baskets, but actually now I have something better. So imagine you're standing at a conveyor belt and you're trying to sort potatoes. So a lot of, let's say, yellow potatoes come by. They're all very washed. And yellow potatoes we like, they're okay, but they're kind of all there. But then there are also some red potatoes, and you want to filter out the red potatoes because they are somehow bad. And the red potatoes, they are not that many. Let's say there are like 80% yellow potatoes, so most of the potatoes are just yellow, then there are 10% red potatoes, and you just try to filter out and pick out the red potatoes. But then there are also some purple potatoes. And purple potatoes are also for some reason okay. They also stand out. They are not yellow, so they are salient compared to the yellow, to most of what you have. But they are irrelevant because you can ignore them. You don't need to pick them out. You only need to pick out the red ones. And how can you ignore or deal with these salient but relevant stimuli, the purple potatoes, and not get distracted, because maybe you will miss a red potato because you're so distracted by a purple one. Turns out people might be able to deal with it somehow, and this is kind of what all of this debate is about. And mostly there are kind of two very big and very long-standing theories on this ground. And one theory is the goal-driven theory, basically, which says only stimuli which match our task can even capture attention. So only red potatoes have the ability to capture our attention, which then means, if you think further, everything else is inhibited. So inhibition is a proactive thing. We proactively inhibit everything which doesn't fit our task. And you don't have to like this theory. It's just out there. Somebody came up with it. And then there's the other side, which says, which is the stimulus-driven account. And here people would say all salient items capture attention in the beginning, and then only in a reactive process, once we figured out they are not relevant for us, this is a purple potato, then they can be suppressed. But this is a reactive process and not proactively. Proactive would mean the purple potatoes are suppressed before you even see them, and before they are near you at the conveyor belt. And the reactive process basically means they pass you on the conveyor belt, you perceive them, but then you don't attend them. Mm-hmm. And now there's a third theory, which is kind of younger, and they say salient items are attended to unless they are inhibited, which is sounds kind of similar to what I said before, but it's also so different that nobody agrees with each other. And so we have kind of these three parties, and this signal suppression hypothesis kind of tried to build the bridge between these two, but they did not really make it. So they say kind of everything, all salient items capture attention, unless we have kind of a mechanism, like a goal-directed mechanism, which inhibits them. Yeah, so this is a long story long. this is kind of, I mean, the starting point. This is, I think, also important to talk about shortly. So what we really try to find out, is there proactive or reactive suppression? Yeah, so this was what our experiment was geared towards. And then it might also make more sense to understand the design choices.
Mm-hmm. And what were the findings of your experiment? You already mentioned earlier that there might be some biases or problems in the setup, but like, what was the outcome?
Yeah, okay, so our experiment was basically, we tried to have a situation in which the participants would need to reactively, so would need reactive suppression, in which where they would have no possibility but to reactively suppress an item. And our idea was, okay, and we will see that you can reactively suppress it. And yeah, so we have kind of some hypothesis. Also, like, we have some stand in this debate, basically, without maybe subscribing to either of these theories in a hard way, but we have some previous papers and we think, like, okay, how will it be? And then how we worked at it, as I said, we used EEG, and there's this technique called event-related potentials, which I might call ERP, which is a common way to say it. So we used ERPs. And so this is a way of analyzing the EEG data, and you just have brain waves and they look a specific way for specific cognitive processes. Let's say it like this. And then there are lots of different event-related potentials for all different kinds of cognitive processes. But they are a bit hard to define, and sometimes you're not sure which event-related potential is related to which cognitive process. And then what we actually found out, okay, there's this one event-related potential. And this is, earlier researchers found out, it's related to basically the attending a target. And this is all fine, but then there was also another event-related potential which was geared, or which earlier researchers found out would be related to suppression of distractors. It's also called the distractor suppression, I think. And anyway, so we could not replicate this component, and so we could not actually find that this component was elicited at the point where it necessarily would have been elicited. And then I read on, and then like way after we started our study, a paper came out, and they also doubted that actually this component, which was formerly known for distractor suppression, might actually not be related to distractor suppression, but something else. And this is also kind of the tricky part with this kind of research. If you're like, you definitely see something is happening in the brain, but you might not always be sure what it relates to. And you try to have this kind of really minimal experiments to be sure, to eliminate all outside variables, but then maybe it's not related at all to distractor suppression, but only to like enumerating items or whatnot, because there's happening a lot of stuff, of course, all the time in the brain, even if you just show them the picture, and then there are a lot of items and they need to do something with it. And of course, we have some idea because we see it in a specific part of the brain, but we cannot be 100% sure. But we can only try with each experiment kind of, okay, we see it in this context. We have created this special situation where the participant should just suppress it, just suppress a certain item. And now we also see this potential. But this is no guarantee. And this is also something, yeah, which kind of we encountered in this research.
So just to wrap it up, you've looked at the event-related potentials, which show brain activity after whatever happened. So after some event has happened, you measure how does the brain react. And there was the hypothesis of having a specific reaction for when you're trying to not perceive something. So when you're actively trying to not perceive stimuli, then there's a specific activation or was expected to be there, but you did not find it. And just as you started to interpret your data, there came out another paper which also said, well, maybe this inhibitory event potential, event-related potential does not even exist. And which matched your findings, because you didn't find it as well. Do you have an idea what those previously described inhibitory event-related potential might have been, or is it just the typical measure your brain, you see what happens, but you can't really explain why it happens?
So maybe it could be just an onset for salient items. I think this was also what I wrote in my thesis. So it's basically just like perceiving there is something, because the potential was there. It was just not there in the situation where we expected. So, I mean, this is also kind of the problem here. It exists definitely, but we just don't know for sure when it is elicited.
After you conducted your experiments, did you like talk to the participants and do they have like an experience? Because like your measurements are one thing, but like the participants, did they feel like they were able to execute the task in the way that you wanted them to? Do you have any experience with that?
Yeah, so we basically tried to make our participants comfortable with the task. And so they would come in and then firstly, for like 15 minutes, half an hour, we would have them do the task until they are comfortable with it. And then, as I said, they should not follow the item or like kind of suppress one item. And then a lot of people also actually said, and I did not even see this item anymore because it was irrelevant. And I think this is interesting that they also like cannot recall it because of course it's something like underlying, which is not maybe conscious to us, but then also it's something they can consciously recall when we ask them like, yeah, how was it for you? We could not really see this one item anymore.
You've just mentioned consciousness, and I wondered, do we need consciousness to suppress stimuli? Or is it just to recall?
What is consciousness? So I think a lot of times when we suppress something which we perceive, then it's not a conscious act. But I mean, there's so much. So when I'm driving my car and I can maybe listen to the radio, but then suddenly there's a situation, I don't know, there's a traffic light coming up and I need to brake, and then I cannot listen to the radio anymore. Or like I don't listen to the radio anymore and I don't know what's happening, or I need to skip back in my podcast, which I was listening in the car. I don't know whether you're supposed to do that anyway. And so I think, a lot of times there's are just really unconscious mechanisms where you don't know what you perceive and what not. And so it's not a conscious process at all, I think. And you can also, of course, try to be attentive to something, and then this also works. But I think the majority of our day, we need to filter out so much because there's so much around us, which is mostly unimportant for the thing we're currently doing. If we would die, I think, immediately of information overload if we try to attend everything which is happening at the same time. And so I think, yeah, mostly it's an unconscious thing. And then there's like sometimes when you do something explicitly, then you can also try to consciously attend something, also consciously suppress something. But I don't know, sometimes when I sat in the library and wanted to study something and people were talking, and I was like, I cannot suppress this right now, even though I really try to. So sometimes you also try to suppress something really consciously, but it might not work. And then I think it's interesting to study why something can be suppressed and some things cannot be that well suppressed.
You've done an lab experiment which mainly required participants to not perceive certain stimuli. How would that apply to real life, except when you're driving a car?
Of course, when you're sorting potatoes. Really. Mm-hmm.
That happens every day.
Which happens every day. So I think it's sometimes hard to think about concrete examples because it is so basic research. But I mean, I talked, or like a child had an example always, basically, if someone asks you to hand you fruit from a fruit basket, and then, I mean, fruits, they're also incredibly colorful and they're all very salient. So we need to think about salient things here. And then somebody asks you, please give me a grape. And grapes are not the most salient fruit, I would say. But then there's this really big red strawberry. And then, but you should not attend the strawberry and just focus to find the grapes in the fruit basket, basically. And so I think this is also, or basically every time you might search, you open a drawer and you open your personal junk drawer and try to find a pen and not get distracted by the rubber ducks yet you have in there or something like this. Nothing I keep in my drawer, but so basically every time you search something in kind of a convoluted space, this is, I think, something where this is really applicable.
I just had to laugh because I was thinking, well, when I'm on some days, I just really want to have specific socks. So I feel like today I need those socks. I don't want to wear any other socks. And then I start looking in my, like I have a box full of socks. I just start looking and often I can't even find those specific socks because I just forget what they were looking like. But I know at least the task of trying to find socks in my box. I don't know where that ended now. Okay. when you're trying to find something specific, is it more like active filtering for the properties this item has? So like, for example, you mentioned grapes, or I mentioned my socks. And for example, when I'm looking for, or when someone is looking for grapes, let's just leave it at the grapes. They know, okay, grapes might be green or they might be purple, dark bluish. And are they specifically scanning for the properties they know this item to have? Or how does the filtering work?
Yeah, so I think this is also something where people will just try to think of what do I know about a grape unconsciously. I mean, you will not try to recall the properties of a grape in your mind like Wikipedia. But so basically what you will just look for is, I mean, let's say we have green grapes and something green, something a specific size, a specific shape. I mean, they are roughly grape sized and oval. And then a thing which is probably going to happen is that you will perceive green grape sized oval objects stronger. And so you can imagine it if you just picture now a fruit basket in your head and then just imagine that these grapes really shine, like very, very strong, and that all other fruits, the bananas and the blueberries and the strawberries, they are all kind of a bit grayish, which is disturbing for fruits, of course. But I mean, this is maybe a thing how you can think about it. And So this would basically be this enhancement based on the items that are like based off the properties of the thing that you're looking for. So you're just looking for green, round, grape-sized objects, and then maybe there are also some other berries which have the same properties, and they would also have enhanced, like they you would also perceive them better, like have an enhanced perception of these other berries. And yeah, this is of course then a bit of a problem, and then you would go closer maybe and find what is the grapes I'm looking for and what is just another distractor. Yeah.
Given that you have like studied attention from a scientific perspective, do you have like something that you took for your personal life? Like if you want to really work on a paper or something that you, let's say like turn off your phone or something, like something that is really, really practical for you in your everyday life?
Yeah, I mean, I think attention hygiene is basically really important. And I think in many aspects of our everyday life, the best way not to get distracted is to avoid having distractors. So if there are no strawberries in the fruit basket, they cannot distract you. And if you don't have your phone around, you cannot be distracted. And I think, yeah, I try to keep my phone not around. I only try to have important mail in my inbox, because I think this is kind of the new attention, news and websites in general, everybody tries to nowadays. I think this is also why this topic is maybe interesting in general, because attention is now such an important resource for people, because advertisement is just playing with your attention and people try to get your attention everywhere. Like in front of videos you will see online, there will be advertisement or you will get newsletters in your inbox. And so I try with wonderful little programs on my browser not to have advertisement in front of my videos, or to only have important mails in my inbox. So basically to not have strawberries in my fruit basket. I only want grapes, because grapes are very yummy.
So maybe you should make grapes your new emoji now.
That's right. I hope there's a good grape emoji. And I now wonder whether there are purple or green grapes.
When I'm trying to recall now, I'm going to mix it up. But I think I've seen them at least, but I can't remember the color.
Yeah.
With all of that being said, do you have something that you think that people should take away if they have listened to this episode, something that really should stick out to them?
It's very difficult to try to wrap something up in concise words here. Yeah, I think the easiest way not to get distracted and to not need to suppress distractors is to not have distractors at all. And if you have distractors, you will be able to deal with them, but it will just make everything a bit harder.
How do you think, like, you have done this double degree for your master's? And I think that's like very, in the sense of the Coxie spirit, like having multiple perspectives on different topics. How do you think that the study of attention really benefits from like a cognitive science perspective and background?
Yeah, I think that's actually really interesting, because I read a lot of different, from a lot of different subfields, I read papers for my thesis, because we mentioned consciousness briefly before, which is a topic which is kind of also based in psychology and neuroscience, but comes, I would say, without being an expert, from philosophy. And then attention, yeah, as I said, is a deeply psychological thing itself. But then also there's this famous paper, Attention is All You Need, which is the paper in machine learning in the last, maybe it's more than 10 years old at this point, but it was a very important paper. And so you see, from machine learning over psychology to to philosophy, somehow attention is always important, and everybody defines it a bit differently. So you always need to make really sure what kind of attention are we talking about. And yeah, as I said, for me, it's mostly like this sensory filter kind of attention.
Thank you so much for pointing that differentiation out once more, because I think, especially me, I was a bit more on a different track of attention at the beginning of our conversation. And I think by now I have a better idea of what you've meant by it, or what you are talking about when you are talking about attention. Let's say it that way. So thank you very much for talking to us, for taking the time to talk about your thesis and explaining in how far we can or cannot suppress some visual stimuli.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
When you enjoy listening to us, the best way to support us is by following us on your chosen podcast app. This could either be Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or the website of a cognitive science student journal. Another good way to support us is by following our Instagram account, which is called kaleidoscience_pod. On our Instagram account, you will also get regular information on the next episode. Thanks a lot for supporting us. This was Kaleidoscience, hosted by Elisa Palmer and Sönke Löw. Produced by Alina Ohnesorge, Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Lukas Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through conversations on cognitive science.